Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome. My name is Suzanne Nasser. Some of you I had a chance to meet earlier, so I appreciate you all being here. I'm a full-time faculty member in the Counseling and Career Development Center. On behalf of the Arab Heritage Month Committee, and please bear with me, I'm so proud to report that this year we were a big group that helped orchestrate the activities for this month, and a diverse group. So I'd like to acknowledge the folks that really helped with this month's activities. So it's myself, Nina Shoman-Dajani, who unfortunately is at a conference today, and she was so sad to miss you, Nadine, but she says hello. Stella Okika, Aurora Zwick, Sundas Mahdi, Najia Omar, Nareda Perez, Nareda, where are you? Thank you. Alicia Humbles, Raya Hussein, and I think that's everybody. So we'd like to welcome you all to today's presentation. Before I introduce our amazing presenter, I'd like to take a minute to thank the Celebrating Diversity Task Force that comes out of Multicultural Student Affairs, is under the leadership and direction of Adrian Stewart, who's sitting back there. So I'd really like to thank the Celebrating Diversity Task Force and Moraine Valley Community College for giving us the opportunity year after year to celebrate Arab Heritage Month. So just to give you a little backdrop, Arab Heritage Month has been celebrated right here in Chicago since 1991. Arab Heritage Month was created to help eliminate discrimination, bigotry, and racism against people of Arab descent. This month gives us a platform to educate the public about Arab culture, civilizations, and contributions to society. It is also a time for us as Arabs to rejoice about who we are and to take pride in our rich culture, history, and traditions. I'm proud to say that Moraine Valley has had a long-standing history and tradition of participating in Arab Heritage Month. Every year, my colleagues and I, along with our hardworking Arab Student Union members, look forward to celebrating this month on campus with all of you. So with that said, we are thrilled to have Dr. Nadine Neber with us today. I first met Dr. Neber at a community event a little under a year ago. I was fortunate to hear her give a talk and then chatted up with her a bit during dinner. I was instantly moved by her commitment to the work she does, and her warmth and genuineness just drew me in. Dr. Neber received her PhD in cultural anthropology at the University of California, Davis. She's an associate professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies and Asian American Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and a member of the Diaspora Studies Cluster. Dr. Neber is the author of Arab America, Gender, Cultural Politics, and Activism. She is co-editor of Race and Arab Americans and Arab American Feminisms. Dr. Neber has been selected as an international fellow with the Open Societies Foundation Academic Fellowship Program to work with the Institute of Women's Studies at Birzeit University in Palestine. She is also the recipient of UIC's Institute for Policy and Civic Engagement's Public Discourse Award. Currently, Dr. Neber is a consultant for the United Nations and is writing an expert report on the social aspects of sustainable development in the Arab region. So, without any further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Nadine Neber, who is here to talk with us today about a timely topic, women and war in the Middle East, with a focus on Palestine and Egypt.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here with all of you, and I thank all of you here at Moraine Valley College for inviting me and having me here. It's also just really commendable that your university, your college has an Arab Heritage Month. Arab Americans are one of the most invisible and misrepresented and underrepresented, or not represented at all, that's why we say invisible, racial and ethnic communities in the United States. And it's really rare that a university or college or even a high school and any institution that deals with issues of diversity and multiculturalism even recognizes Arab culture and Arab heritage. So I give you a big round of applause to your own institution for its fabulous work and all the people behind that effort. So I work with Arab immigrant communities, and I also work, and I especially work on gender issues with Arab immigrant women And I write books about these topics. And I also work with women in different Arab countries who are living in a situation of war. So basically, my areas of expertise are gender, immigration, and war. And so when those three areas come together, and actually, I'll just say that anyone who's a researcher and is writing usually has some beef. You know, usually have some beef with something, and you want to change it or you want to make an intervention. So I'll just put that up front, you know, and I'm going to try to make this relevant to you as maybe people who are interested in research and help you think about what researchers do. So one thing, for example, as far as like what intervention I'm involved in making with a lot of other researchers working in my area is we're trying to talk to people who study war. And we're trying to say that all of that work is really important and we need to challenge the violence of war. But we also need to think about the gender aspects of war. So that the challenge of the intervention is that war impacts men and women differently. But usually the way war is talked about is usually in terms of how it impacts men only. So when you say like, you know, people died and this happened, it's usually about the men, even though it doesn't say men. And it kind of ignores the gendered aspects or the way that women are experiencing wars. So people coming from the Arab region working on a lot of the wars that are at play now who are working with women are trying to make that intervention of the people who are studying war. So I'm going to walk you through that to show you what that looks like. And the point of that isn't to say that on the one hand we need to study war, and then it's like a side topic to say, oh, and then here's the women. What we're trying to say is that gender is part of how war works. Wars always work according to ideas and stereotypes or attacks on women and men that operate differently. Can any of you think of an example of how war might affect women or men differently? And you can even think of the United States, like people going to serve in the army or something you know about any war you've studied. Can you think of any example?
During World War II, Soviet Union drafted millions of women. We often don't hear about that.
Yeah, the drafting of women. And when women get drafted, they have different types of experiences in war. So that's a good example. What else? Just anything on how war could impact women differently than men. Yes?
There was the controversy on the cover of Times magazine of the female soldiers wanting to rescue their children.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, how do you be a mother when you're in a war? Okay, great. Okay, so we'll get into that more. So then there's another kind of beef or intervention that I work on and I'm trying to, you know, push forward in the research world and the world of advocacy. And that is to the women's movement and people who care about women's rights. So often the women, especially in the United States, the dominant women's movement, the one that gets most attention, doesn't usually take up issues of war. And they also often think about war as something separate than and not a woman's movement concern. And what we're trying to say is, look, a lot of people who come from countries that are facing war and are women, war is like their main concern. And so if you want to deal with women from the Arab region, you really need to think about the issue of war as a woman's issue. So I'll tell you more about. So it's basically like war as a feminist issue. That's an intervention. So we'll talk about what that looks like. Now a third intervention, so these are all kind of takeaway points for you. That war is gendered. What did I just say? War is a feminist issue. And the third would be that it seems like you're interested or your college is talking about anti-Arab racism as something we should all think about. So also people who fight against Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism, like the idea that all Arabs are terrorists or potential terrorists or we should be suspicious of them or that Arabs have a backwards culture and their religion of Islam is uncivilized and promotes violence. These are all racial stereotypes. So the other intervention is that those stereotypes actually also rely on gender. So that intervention is basically to say when we think about anti-Arab racism, we also need to think about the gender aspect of it. So what would be a gender aspect of anti-Arab racism? Who are we talking about? Who is the media talking about when it portrays Arabs as terrorists or potential terrorists? Who are those characters who appear as the terrorists in film? They're men. So what do Arab women appear as when it's like a negative image in the media? Oppressed. So the gender aspect of the racism is this idea that all Arab women are super oppressed and they're silent victims of this backwards culture, and their men are misogynist and abuse them, and they walk 10 feet behind their men, and they have no rights, and they can't drive, and. So that's the gender aspect of the racism. So that would be the third intervention, that when we think about racism, we also need to think about how it impacts women and men differently. So if you're an Arab man and you're walking into a racist situation, someone might be like, oh, watch that guy, you know, he might have a bomb under his, you know, under his coat. But if a woman walks in, people might think a racial assumption might be different. It's like, oh, that poor thing, so horrible that she comes from this culture that oppresses women so badly. So that's like the gender aspect of racism. So that would be the three interventions of how we need to bring gender into these other things and not just say that gender or women's issues are these separate things. Like, oh, I'm gonna take a women's studies class to learn about women, and then I'm gonna take a racism class to learn about racism. What we're trying to say is the gender stuff should be in the racism class. So now what I'm gonna do is start with just saying a few things from the research about how wars generally affect women. And then I'll go into some of the examples from Palestine and Egypt. So this is gonna be really quick because this isn't even the main focus. So one is that the rhetoric of war uses women's bodies. So it uses assumptions about women's oppression to justify war. So I'm just gonna walk through this. Some of you might be familiar with it. So when the United States went to war in Afghanistan, after the horrific attacks of September 11th, the Bush administration said, does anyone know, one of the reasons we're going to war is to, anyone know?
Move the Taliban
and liberate the women. So you were probably, I'm guessing, maybe in high school or maybe elementary school, middle school, around the time. So you might not have seen a lot of the media images, but maybe some of the faculty members, do you remember that? That whole thing about, you know, there were so many images in the US media about how oppressed Afghan women are, that they are covered from head to toe, and that became a huge thing that the Bush administration used over and over to justify to the American public why we need to go to Afghanistan. So that ideas about women can be used to justify a war. So that's one way wars affect women. Because what that does is it reinforces the idea that racial idea that, oh, those women have it so bad, we need to save them. So it basically creates this hierarchy between Americans and Muslims, that like they have this backwards culture, we have a civilized culture, and we need to go there and save them and rescue them from all of that, and that's why we're gonna go bomb them. So number two, how else does war affect women? Sometimes resistance movements, like people who are fighting back against a war, so maybe in Arab countries, people who are fighting back against the United States, they also use women when they're fighting back. So they say, oh, you guys are gonna come here because you want to do something related to our women? Well, we're gonna protect our women. So it's basically like the US would say, let's say, the veil, the hijab that some Muslim women wear, the US media will make it appear that the veil is a symbol of oppression and a symbol of backwards culture. So that's a racial idea. But then they're basically saying you need to unveil if you want to be civilized. So then the people fighting back will say, oh, you're gonna tell us that our women should unveil? Well, we're gonna tell our women they need to veil as a way to fight back against you. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's basically like men on both sides having an argument about what women should do. So it's basically a fight between men about women's bodies. So that's a way that war affects women, because it makes the stakes really high about how women should live their life. It makes it like, if let's say you're in a country where this is happening and your community is saying you need to put the veil on because the veil is a way we're gonna fight US empire or US imperialism and US domination over our country. So you need to veil because that's a sign of resistance. So then if you decided you didn't want to wear the veil, then you could be seen as a traitor to your people, or that you're betraying your community's cause. But the problem with that is the veil no longer becomes about, you know, religiosity, about a woman's relation to God, about her own choice of whether or not she should veil. The veil then becomes this thing that men are having a debate about and you get kind of sucked into. So that's another way that war affects women, that decisions about women's lives become these larger political issues. Okay, so another piece that I'm going to talk about today a little more is that war itself is patriarchal. That means that wars are born out of these ideas about masculinity. They're kind of shaped by these ideas that, you know, the male hero. It doesn't mean that all men believe that wars are good or that all men are violent. It just means that one of the ideas behind war is this idea of the male hero saving his country or, you know, being the savior of, again, your nation. And so what goes along with that often and sadly is violence against women. So the war culture is a violent culture, and because it's also a patriarchal culture, it entails violence against women. Every single war entails violence against women. There's no question about it. Wars increase the rates of domestic violence. So when the US is in a war time, the rates of domestic violence are higher, especially for the families of soldiers. So when people come back from war, domestic violence increases. In war, there's a great deal of rape and sexual harassment. There's a movie out recently called The Invisible War, and it's about the violence against women in the US military currently. And a lot of people didn't want that movie to air because they said it makes people might be critical of US war if they see that movie. But a lot of feminists were saying, you know, we need to show that movie to show what's really going on in the military, because it's a culture of violence that often plays out on women's bodies. But you can't really talk about it, because if you talk about it, again, you could be seen as a traitor or that you're not patriotic because you want to criticize what's going on in the army. So anyway, so when countries go to war, they often, and this happened with the US war in Iraq, it happens when the Israelis are on Palestinian land, they often target the people that they're targeting. They often target women's bodies in the war. So you have like, and one of the ideas behind it is that women's bodies in nation states, so in the idea of what a state is supposed to be, there's often this idea that a woman's body symbolizes the land. So can you give me an example of any symbol in the United States that's a symbol of America, but is also a symbol of a woman's body? The Statue of Liberty. So that's a perfect example of the idea of a woman's body symbolizing the nation. So what that means is, what would you want to do if you want to target that nation and destroy it or send a message that you have won or that you have dominated another country? If a woman's body represents the country, target the woman's body. And so that's partly why the logic of war is a war that relies on sexual violence as a tool of war. So sexual violence is a tool of war, and because women's bodies are often a symbol of the land. So that's what I'm going to focus on, and it's a little bit of a depressing topic. So if this topic is something that you don't feel like talking about or hearing about today, or it triggers something you know emotional, I would, I'm okay with you not staying for the lecture, because I am going to give a couple examples of that. So women's bodies get targeted in war. And then there are a few other things that happen in war in general. This is all from the research on women and war, is that when men are absent, because men, you know, in a war situation, a lot of times men are on the front lines more than women. So that means that the burdens on women increase. So you're not just, let's say, responsible as a mother for your kids, but then you might also have to be doing the job that your spouse might have been doing when he was home. So the labor that women do often intensifies and increases during times of war. Poverty, of course, is a consequence of war, and poverty has specific impacts on women, especially since women are responsible for children. Poverty impacts mothers in a particular way because you can't feed your kids and all the burdens that come along with that. let's see. So I'm not going to talk anymore about the general, but those are just some examples of why some feminist scholars and gender studies scholars are saying that war needs to be thought of in terms of gender. So now I'm going to go to Palestine. How many of you know anything about Palestine and Israel and the conflict? Raise your hands really high. Okay, so my talk is 30 minutes, so I will probably have 2 minutes to give you just a little context. And of course, there's no way to do justice to the complexity of the situation. But this map just kind of helps with what I'm going to talk about. And you're more than welcome in the question and answer to challenge what I said, have a different opinion, or ask more questions. But I'm really just trying to get to the gender aspect for now. So all I'm using this map for right now is to give you a sense of what the war situation is about there. What it's about is land. It's about the fact that the United States supports Israel, and the Israeli state has taken land away from Palestinian people. That's like the simplest way I could put it right now without going into a lot about it, but you're more than welcome to ask about it later. So this is just what I'm talking about. You could see 1947, the green is Palestinian land, and the white is Jewish settlements. These are Jews who immigrated from Europe at the time, and they built these settlements. And then over time, in 1948, the State of Israel was created on Palestinian land. And so over time, Palestinians have lost more and more land. But the way the US media portrays it is that the Palestinians are terrorists, and they're violently attacking Israelis. And the Israelis are acting in self-defense when they bomb Palestinians and they engage in massacres like the massacre in Gaza last summer. They portray it as if it's self-defense. But what they leave out are the historical conditions that produced Palestinian violence. So they leave out that Palestinians have been involved in a resistance movement fighting to stop this process in which their land is being taken away more and more each day. So it's a violent conflict, but it's not a war with two equal sides. There's one group that's supported by the United States, which is the Israeli state, and they have a great deal of resources, and they're occupying another people's land, and those are the occupied people, the Palestinians. So it's a relationship of power. There's the occupier, Israel, and the occupied, which is the Palestinians. So it's unequal. So that's why it's not a war or a conflict. It's actually a situation of occupation. Some people use the word colonization, which needs a discussion if we're going to talk about it in that way for now. So I'm just going to show you the map to give you a sense of that unequal power dynamic here and what Palestinians are fighting over. So this is the present, the last map right here, where you see that their land is just dwindling and dwindling each day, but Palestinians haven't give up, and they are continuing to fight back to try to keep their land, and also they're fighting for their own state, which hasn't yet happened, but has been promised and promised and promised over and over. So how do women have to deal, how does this affect women? So a lot of times the Israeli state participates in invasions of Palestinians' homes, demolitions of Palestinian homes, as well as massacres that happen where, you know, there'll be bombing, soldiers raid Palestinians' homes often, and they'll arrest Palestinians en masse. But they'll use the idea that Palestinians are a threat or they're potential terrorists, and that's why they need to lock them up. But a lot of times, Palestinians who get locked up, they're usually youth, they get locked up because they're either resisting the Israelis by maybe throwing a stone or even speaking at a demonstration, or they're not doing anything, and it's just more of an intimidation tactic to say, we're going to put all of you in jail so that, you know, your friends will know better or you'll know better than to even try to fight back. So it's more of like an intimidation repression sort of tactic. And so so all the time this has been happening, you know, since 1948. And when it happens, women's bodies often get used in the process. So one of the things, so two things about the Palestinian situation that I'll talk about. One, remember we talked earlier in class about the racial stereotypes about Arab culture? I know I'm saying so many things, but it's important to point out that, I'll just say it clearly now, one of the main stereotypes you have in the United States about Arab culture is what? You could say them. What do you see in the media over and over? Like, what's the way Arabs or Muslims are portrayed? So one, we said potential terrorists. And what's the other one we already said? Oppressed women, right? You rarely will ever see an image of like a regular Arab woman on TV, someone who is powerful or speaks up or is just going to school and going to work. You know, it's usually like some other situation. But anyway, the point of that is that central to stereotypes of Arab culture that come from the West that Israel and the US both hold is that Arab families are really traditional and conservative in a negative way, that they kind of like control their kids, they control their daughters, they control their wives. So this idea of family is a stereotype that kind of negatively, you know, positions Arab families. So what it assumes, there's this idea of like honor and shame that come up over and over in the history of European and US portrayal of Arab culture. This idea that, you know, if you do something against your family, that would be like the biggest shame to your family name. And, you know, Arabs are really strong about that, so, you know, you don't want to mess up your family name. But it's portrayed in a negative way, in a negative light, that's an example of how backwards and uncivilized Arabs are, that their families are like that, and they're so controlling over each other. So what the Israelis do, and the US also does in Iraq, is they use these gender stereotypes in the process of dominating Arab people. So what'll happen in an Israeli prison, the Israelis will also arrest women all the time, and they arrest them and they become political prisoners. And again, it's for the same reason. It's if you're a woman and you are speaking up against Israel, they'll arrest you. Or if you're not, they'll still arrest you to send a message to other women, you know, not to speak up or not to participate in any protest. So they'll arrest women, and when they do it in a way that uses these stereotypes. So what they'll do is and I'm not gonna go into details of the torture or the assault, but they'll put someone under interrogation. And then they'll use stereotypes about Arab culture in the interrogation. So they'll assault a woman's body, and then they'll say, now I'm gonna bring in your father to watch. And the assumption there is that we're gonna do this because that's the most horrific thing you could do to an Arab. And that itself is a racist idea that, you know, it's exceptionally horrific for an Arab to watch their daughter be sexually assaulted, as if that wouldn't be horrific for anyone on planet Earth. You know, and the same thing happened in Iraq. If you might have heard of the Abu Ghraib torture case, where the United States soldiers put Iraqi men, they undressed them, and they put them in same-sex positions. They piled their bodies on top of each other. And they took all these photos of them, and the photos made it to the US. But they were putting the Iraqi men in same-sex positions. And what they said was, we did this to humiliate them. Because for Arabs and Muslims are so homophobic that the worst thing you could ever do to an Arab man is to put him in a same-sex position. So first, there's a stereotype that Arabs are the most homophobic people on planet Earth, which is part of the idea that Arabs are so backwards when it comes to gender. And two, there's the idea that that wouldn't be horrific for anyone else in the world. So in a way, what it does is when you say something like that, what it does is it takes away the focus on the torture itself. And it puts the focus on Arab culture. So instead of saying, oh my gosh, they're putting prisoners in same-sex positions and torturing them, then you end up saying, oh, that would be so horrible if you were Arab. Do you see what I'm saying? So it shifts the focus away from what the state is doing, the US state, to a focus on the backwardsness of the people. So that's what this kind of like gender thing does. So let me talk about Palestine a little bit. So so one thing that happens is when an Israeli raids a Palestinian home, men are usually not home because it's during the day and the men might be at work. So women are there by themselves. So that kind of increases the possibility for Palestinian women bodies to be assaulted. Another thing that happens is that the new issue, so these issues of like assault that happened between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian women have been going on since 1948. But a new issue that's come up over the past 10 years, if you notice here, see right here where that mouse is? See, it's kind of like specks. What those are, they're basically the white part in between the green. They're Israeli-only roads. And there's a wall there, kind of like the Berlin Wall or kind of like South African apartheid. So what it does is it separates Palestinians from each other. So basically, there are Israeli-only roads that only Israelis can go on. But Palestinians, then they can't get to, let's say, their cousin or their relative who lives like a few blocks away because of all that white part in between the screen part. So there's all these checkpoints. So if you want to actually cross over from like one part of this green to another, there's an Israeli soldier there and he stops you. And lots of Israeli soldiers. And you have to, has anyone ever been through an Israeli checkpoint? Okay, so some of you are familiar with it. So, you know, it's anything can happen at a checkpoint. You could sit there for 8 hours and never get through. You could get arrested. You could get turned back. You don't know what's going to happen. But Palestinians do this all day long, every single day, because they have to get to work or to school or wherever else. Or they have to go pray. So anyway, one of the latest things that's been going on that's related to gender is that the Israeli state stops pregnant women when they're in labor from getting through a checkpoint in order to get to a hospital to have their baby. So this is another issue that is about gender, because when we said that women's bodies represent the land, I said about the Statue of Liberty, we said that. One of the reasons I didn't go into of why a woman's body represents the land and the people, now that I talked about pregnancy, does anyone want to guess? Why would a woman's body be seen by, you know, an outside force that wants to take over your people? Why would they see a woman's body as something to target? Reproduction. Because she's going to have the babies. She's going to produce the future Palestinians. And in any war, that's the case, that women's bodies get targeted because you see the woman as the bearer of the future soldiers. So you either need to protect her or you need to destroy her. So in this case of the pregnancy, the analysis that people are giving this situation, because it's systematic, it's not random, it's not just a pregnant woman happened to be trying to get through. It's that it's been documented by Amnesty International, you could do research on it, that it's a systematic practice that women who are pregnant are having a hard time getting through checkpoints. And I think 62 cases in 2012 with babies dying or the mom not getting the health care she needs. And even after they make it through the checkpoint, they might not get the health care they need because then there's all these issues with permits and getting to the hospital and not getting to the hospital late. So that's a big issue that is a perfect example of, we talked about sexual assault, you know, targeting women's bodies, and the example of the pregnancy is a really big one right now that a lot of people are trying to work on. Now I'm going to talk about the issue of political prisoners, and maybe I won't even go into the Egypt thing, so I think that might be enough. So as far as the political prisoners, this is something not talked about very much, that Palestinian women are sexually assaulted in Israeli jails. And part of it is that people don't want to reveal that that happened to someone in your family. And people are worried that that could affect your chances of getting married after you get out of jail, or that you could have a bad reputation. So that's actually the point of the sexual assault. The point of the sexual assault is to say that parents will then tell their daughters, I don't want you to be involved in politics. I don't want you to challenge the Israelis, because you could go to prison and get sexually assaulted and your whole future will be ruined. So what it does is one of the purposes is to crush the possibilities for Palestinian women's political participation. So, you know, it basically creates fear. And the fear is gendered, that you don't want to do that because you could get raped. So basically, several women scholars have been interviewing Palestinian women who have served in Israeli jails, and there's a lot of research now that documents what happens. I'm not going to go into any details except to say that, again, there's this issue of bringing the woman's father in to actually enact the assault sometimes even, or a family member, or just another male prisoner. So that, again, relying on these stereotypes about Arab culture and Arab family. And then what happens to women is that they're kind of caught between the Israelis and their own community. Because the Israelis, of course, I already mentioned what's happening to them, but then their own community, just like it would happen in the United States, what happens a lot of times, if any of you have studied sexual assault in the United States, when a woman reports that she's been raped? Do people believe her? There is a serious problem in the United States with rape, and it's on college campuses especially. And one of the biggest problems with it is women don't come forward, and two, no one believes them. Three, they get called sluts and prostitutes. So they get blamed. She was wearing shorts. She said, you know, she was drunk. She was walking down the wrong street. So the blame gets put on the woman. So similar here, that the same thing happens. It's a patriarchal society, just like the United States, where a woman gets sexually assaulted, she gets out of jail, and they say, it's your fault. You know, you brought it on. You were involved in the protest. You shouldn't have done that in the first place. So she gets caught between her, and then again, her reputation gets ruined, blah, blah, blah. So she gets caught between her own community and the Israelis. So, but here's a really, I think, powerful and amazing point about this is, I don't want you to hear this and think, oh, that's so horrible, what's happening to these Palestinian women, you know, and I don't want you to see them as victims. Because to see a woman who survives torture and sexual abuse as a victim only makes the problem worse. Because what it does is it basically reinforces the idea that she needs to be saved or helped, as opposed to giving her the resources and power she needs to become strong and help herself, or change the structures that led to the violence in the first place, right? So what we need to do is change the system as opposed to, you know, victimizing the victim. So in Palestine, there is a new scholar at a university there that's writing about this, and I wanted to read you something from an interview she did with a woman who was sexually assaulted in an Israeli prison. The woman, and this is a pseudonym, and this scholar is trying to challenge, remember I said all scholars have a beef? So she has a beef. Her name is Lina Miadi, and she's a professor at Beit Hazeit University. And she has a beef that all the research she ever read on Palestinian women in Israeli jails portrays the women as victims. And it only talks about the abuse that happens to them. But it doesn't talk about how they perceived it, or their voice about it, or their sense of, like, you know, what they thought about it. It just talks about what someone did to them. So here's what Professor Lina Miadi says. I'm reading from an interview that she did. During the 80 days of my interrogation, I didn't cooperate with the interrogators. However, my sumud at the time, does someone want to translate sumud? I was thinking, my steadfastness, or my strength, my persistence. This is a really strong word in Palestinian society for Arab Heritage Month. Sumud is something that Palestinians really want to have, and they try to build it within themselves. Like, how do you be strong in the face of oppression? It's S-U-M-U-D. So she says, my samud did not stem from a heroic position. It stemmed from my mother's personality. Because basically, you get interrogated, and you get tortured, and the purpose of the torture is to force you to make a confession about something you didn't do. And then you make the confession, and the Israeli military charges you and convicts you for the thing you confessed to, and then you go to jail. So it's basically a confession that comes out of a process of torture. And usually the person is innocent, or they might not be, depends, but you don't know, because there's no fair trial, and there's torture used for the confession. So she says that during the interrogation, she refused to give in. She would not confess. And also what happens during the interrogation is they try to get you to tell on other people. So they say, who is your neighbor? What is he involved in? And then you have to basically tell on your friends or you get tortured. So she says, my Samoa didn't stem from my heroic position. It stemmed from my mother's personality. My mother was a very stubborn and proud person. She encouraged us, her daughters, to be strong and proud. My mother planted ethical values in us. That's what mobilized our Samud. I couldn't cause damage to anyone I knew. That means telling on anyone she knows. I refused to write anything in front of the interrogator, even my name. It is not that I wasn't afraid during the interrogation. I was horrified when they called me to the interrogation room and when they stripped off my clothes and threatened to rape me or to bring my mother to the interrogation. But I was able to gather all my power and remember the pride my mother cultivated in us. For me, dignity is key. If you have dignity, you can resist. A whole political culture of collective dignity and support had developed. Samud took root within this culture. So I thought I would share that with you for Arab Heritage Month, that it's not only about being victimized by war or living in oppression, but it's also about how people find ways to develop strength and resistance and power. So what I'm going to go to now is a story that is close to Chicago, and I'm going to end with this story. I brought something that is about Arab women and war, but that is something directly related to our lives here in Chicago and Illinois. So there is this woman. How many of you have heard of Rasmiya Oda? Raise your hands. Okay, so about a quarter of you. So Rasmiya Oda is a Palestinian woman. She's 68 years old. And she's actually from Palestine, from a village that was nearby. There was a massacre in 1948 when the State of Israel was created, and her family fled. And they lost their home to Israelis. So their home was taken away, and they grew up first in a tent with 19 people, a refugee tent, and then they grew up in a house until she was in two bedrooms, actually not a house, but in two bedrooms with 19 people until she finished high school. So she had a pretty rough life. She'd seen dead bodies, burned bodies, massacres, people dying all the time. She lost a sister during an Israeli raid. This was her life. She was picked up in a prisoner sweep when, in 1969, Israelis picked up, or 67, picked up 500 Palestinians. This is common. So they'll pick up a whole group. And a lot of her family members were picked up. She was taken to an interrogation, and she was sexually assaulted and tortured for 45 days. And then she was forced to confess that she committed a bombing that she didn't commit. So she talks about it, about the confession. And because her father was actually, I'm not going to go into the details because I think it's actually not appropriate. It's too much and too intense. But she talks about how her father was brought in during the torture. And she was also afraid of what they were going to do to her father, and that was when she confessed. So she says, fearing that my father might lose his life from one moment to the next because of the torture he was enduring, Alda readied herself to make the confession that they wanted so they would leave her father alone. So she said her interrogators accused her of planting a bomb in a Jerusalem supermarket, an act which Arda testified she never carried out. The interrogators realized that perfectly well because they brought her to the supermarket, and she says, and asked me to point out where I had put the explosive. Of course, I didn't know the place, and I said, where exactly do you want me to show you where I put this explosive charge? So they showed me where the explosion had taken place, and I actually pointed out that place without being able to give any details of the operation. I didn't even know how the operation had taken place. So again, we're dealing with this theme of how women's bodies are used in interrogation to make everyone else in Palestine not participate in resistance. She was always, her whole family was always spoke up against the Israeli occupation. But here's what's amazing about Rasmiya. She was the first Arab woman ever to publicly testify about being sexually assaulted in prison. So she went to jail for 10 years, and she went to the United Nations in 1979, and she testified and told the whole story of what happened to her. Then she was exiled. She never got to go back to Palestine. She was taken to Libya, to Switzerland, because in Israel, in their Israeli documents, she is down in record as being a bomber. So she was exiled when she served her time in jail, and she was let out of jail through a prisoner exchange, which again shows that she was a political prisoner. You don't exchange a regular criminal. You exchange people in war, criminals of war, prisoners of war, I meant. So anyway, she goes to Jordan, and then her father comes to the US because he has cancer and he's getting cancer treatment. And then her family asks her, because she never had the chance to get married, because her fiance was also imprisoned with her, and they never got to be together. So he, and they were also, when she got out of prison, she couldn't go back to Palestine, so again, she couldn't be with him. So she never got married, never had a family. She ended up being the only woman in her family who was single and unmarried, so the family expected her to take care of the dad when he was sick with cancer. So she came to the United States in 2004, and she ended up in Chicago. She came to take care of her father who had cancer. She came to Chicago, and her father died of cancer. And then she started what's called the Arab Women's Committee, which is where I met Suzanne. And the Arab Women's Committee is the only place like this in the United States. It's basically a committee that serves the needs of immigrant and refugee women. So if you come here from Iraq and you've just come out of a refugee camp, if you're coming from the crisis in Syria, you come to the US, you don't know English, you've been traumatized by, you know, you probably have post-traumatic stress syndrome from living through a war, you're living in poverty, you are wearing the hijab, and people are looking at you like, you know, you're a foreigner, and then you can't speak English back. You have to get your kids in school, you have to go to the hospitals, you don't know anything about what's going on around you. So you go to the Arab Women's Committee, where Rasmiya is the leader, and she ended up building a group with 600 immigrant and refugee women who come to her for help. So in 2013, I'm gonna end at 12, is that okay? In 2013, the US Department of Justice arrested her. And they said that when she filled out her immigration papers, she didn't say that she was in jail in Israel 40 years ago. So this is a very clear case where the government is using immigration fraud to target someone for a political reason, because the US supports Israel, and the US is trying to criminalize and imprison and scare anyone in the US who's an activist in support of Palestinian rights. And I could tell you more about that if you want to ask in the question answer. And she is affiliated with people in the United States who do constitutionally protected free speech activities, like they go to protests or they organize events to share information about what's happening in Palestine. So the reason that I said, one of the reasons you could easily tell that this is a politically motivated arrest is that she filled out her immigration papers 10 years ago. So it's really rare that the US would get someone on immigration fraud for a paper they filled out 10 years ago. But there are a lot of other reasons, and I'm not gonna go into the case because of the time, but I'm more than happy. I know a lot about it. You could ask me pretty much anything. So she just went to trial. The trial was in Detroit last week, and the trial lasted 4 days, and it was the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security against this 68-year-old woman who has been sexually tortured for a crime she didn't commit and in jail already for 10 years and lost family members, et cetera, and is the main person for these 600 immigrant women to go to. And she just had a trial in Detroit, and the jury, they found her guilty. So she is now in jail in the United States, in Port Huron, Michigan. And usually they take people, she was out on bail, and they usually don't take you to jail until you're sentencing. So the trial was ended on November 10th, and the sentencing's in March. And I was there, and everyone there, we all didn't know what was gonna happen. We thought maybe she will get convicted, but no one would have ever expected that they would put her in handcuffs at that moment and take her away. And they only do that if you're like a serial killer. They revoked her bail. And they did it on the grounds that they said that 40 years ago she was in jail in Israel and she tried to escape. And they also said that she has nobody here in this country, so that she's a flight risk. And in fact, there were 100 people in the courtroom every day from Chicago, from her community, to support her. So it was really difficult on everybody. But the reason I'm telling you this story is because she's the strongest woman I know. She's given me a lot of strength. because she always reminded people that the most important thing is to fight for what's right and to fight for justice, you know, and not put your head down and just accept when you see something happening that's unjust. So what she did is she gave everyone else strength, and she told everyone before she went to jail, don't be sad. We have to keep fighting for justice. And I think the reason I'm sharing this with you is because I wanted to make the lecture relate to your lives as people in the United States. I didn't want to make it like, here are these Arab women who live in the Middle East, and it's some far issue away from you. But I'm sharing this story to help to give you tools to help you challenge the existing stereotypes about Arab women. That here's a woman who was sexually tortured. She went and testified in front of the United Nations when no one in her, any country, anyone from the Arab world has ever done that before. And then when she was convicted in the United States again, I want to show you what she said. I have a video. And it's really powerful. It's she was convicted at 11 a.m. and they took her away at 2 p.m. So between 11 and 2, she was outside the courtroom. And she was with all her community waiting to hear the verdict, waiting to hear the sentencing. She had already heard the verdict. She knew she was found guilty, and she was now waiting to find out what they were going to do with her. I'm going to show you what she said, and it's really incredible. So here she is. So these are the people outside the Detroit courthouse. How's the sound? So there she is.
Okay, everybody, thank you for supporting me. Shukran Elkhom ala Ja'al Kili.
Have you seen this?
Okay, I think you get the point. So basically, the takeaway points then are there is a war, of course. There are lots of wars taking place in the Arab world. And those wars are wars on Arab people. But they're also wars and between Arab people. And they're also wars on women's bodies. And those wars also exist within the United States. They're not issues that are these countries far away where people are fighting. They're wars that our government is deeply, deeply implicated in. And so what that means is that when people come to this country from those places that the US is involved in, they also face struggles and the effects of that war inside the United States. And that affects women in particular ways. And then the racial stereotypes against Arabs are often used to justify war. I mean, every time there's racism, there's no one racism. Like, there's racism against black people, and it came out of the history of slavery. And it was used originally to justify slavery, that we need to have them as slaves because they are less than human, so they can be our slaves. So people believe that, or they buy into it, or they pretend to make them feel better. Then when there was Native American genocide, it was a different racial logic. It said that, you know, the time is up, I'm not gonna go into it. But anti-Arab racism works differently, just like all the racism works differently. Anti-Arab racism says they're backwards and uncivilized, and they have a potential for violence because they're savage. So therefore, it's okay for us to go to war there. So where anti-black racism justifies slavery and today poverty and criminalization of black people, anti-Arab racism is justified through the logic of war. So when you see racism here against Arabs, it's not just about here. It's actually about the wars that are going on, because it's directly related to the wars. And women are very much part of the racism, and women are very much part of the wars. So we need to connect all those things. Sorry that wasn't so uplifting, but I hope seeing Rasmiya's speech reminds you, because she's asking us to be strong and not be sad and not feel victimized, that we have to stay strong. And she's saying that to all the people who love her. So I'll pass that to you, the strength that she gave me. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that thought-provoking presentation. Feeling a little emotional about Rasmiya. But what we're going to do now is open it up for questions and answer. And if anybody has any thoughts, would like Nadine to elaborate on anything, now's the time to do so. Yes, and we need you to use the mic so that they can catch it on camera.
Hi, my name is Zach Williams, and I found your points about the Israeli checkpoints and the pregnancy very interesting. Do you think that perhaps the Israeli policies were formed by the oppression that the Jewish settlers formed in the pre-independence period at the hands of, say, the 1934 pogrom, or the King David Hotel bombing, or the Fedayeen massacres that went on from 48 to 72?
So do I think those are a continuation of them?
Or that they shaped Israeli policy towards the Palestinians?
The earlier massacres and when they took
instances of Palestinian on Jewish settler violence.
I don't think that you can point to those two direct events, because I think that we need to look at the whole historical development of the problem. So, you know, because if we point to those two events, we could point to other events that happened a month ago, you know, or 2 months ago, where Palestinians maybe threw rockets into Israel, you know.
So I'll ask, get rid of the two isolated events, but these Fedayeen, these raids, they went on for 20, 24 years.
But so
could that be explained by it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my personal opinion is that the, all I'm saying is you could say the same thing that Israel could say, that Hamas has been attacking, or Palestinians have been attacking Israel, you know, for 20 years. But what I'm saying is that I think we need to look at the whole entire historical context, where Palestinians have this sense and experience that's why I showed the maps, because I think we could point to whatever incidents, but when you look at the larger history of land confiscation, then it helps us think about that the larger Israeli project is a project of colonization, of land confiscation, right? And the displacement of the people off of their land. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the pregnancy thing is more shaped, the attacks on people at checkpoints and Palestinian women is shaped more by the logic of colonization. Okay. That it's about reducing the number of Palestinians and making the situation so unlivable that Palestinians will leave. So I think
thus
it's
creating
more
a Jewish homeland?
Yes. Well, no, not necessarily, because you can have both. The idea isn't for Israelis necessarily to leave and for it to be Palestinians' land, mm-hmm. but it's how can everyone live there in a way where they're treated equally, right?
Right.
But the current situation is that it's not that. There's such an extreme hierarchy. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but my main answer would be that I think that that practice towards the women mm-hmm. is shaped more than anything else by the project of taking Palestinians' land
okay.
than a reaction to Palestinian resistance at any moment for any period of years.
Okay.
Does that help?
It does.
Okay, thank you so much.
So I know today you were supposed to talk about Egypt a little
oh,
bit,
yeah.
and I guess there wasn't enough time.
Yeah.
But could you give us an example
sure.
of in Egypt where war affects women?
That's a great question. Thanks for asking it. So what I was going to talk about Egypt is that there was a revolution in 2011. How many of you know about the Egyptian revolution or the Arab Spring revolutions? Raise your hand. Okay, so in 2011, Egyptian people basically went to the street and took down their dictator. And they took down a dictator who had been in power for 30 years. And one of the things that happened following the revolution, his name was President Hosni Mubarak, is that there was a really extreme period of state violence. So the people who took over, it was a transition period, and they were called the SCAF. They're a security force. They were kind of the transitional government. And when they were in power, they enacted a lot of extreme violence against their own people. So I was going to talk about, it's not necessarily a war, but it's a context of state violence against their own population. So what happened was, and I'll say it in 1 minute, all of a sudden in the United States, because I was trying to relate everything to what you see in the news, there was like this sensationalized stories about sexual harassment in Egypt. So if you Googled sexual harassment in Egypt, you would get like a million, whatever you call it, hits. And then Hillary Clinton came out against sexual harassment in Egypt. A lot of like really big names were like, oh my God, sexual harassment in Egypt. But what I was trying to show in the talk is how the whole 30-year period of Mubarak's rule involved, as well as after Mubarak, involved the state, because that's what my whole talk was about. It was about state violence, like the Israelis, and then I was going to give the example of Egypt. I was trying to challenge the way we think about violence against women, because violence against women is usually thought, when we say violence against women, what do you think of? Rape. So rape is an example of individual act of violence, like one person enacting violence on another. And then domestic violence, right? Again, that's one person enacting violence on another. But what I was trying to do in the talk is say, I was trying to encourage us to change the way we define violence against women and to define and to broaden it to include state violence. Because people get really worked up when you hear sexual harassment in the streets or rape. They say, oh my God, that's so horrible. Because you don't have to be responsible for it. It's someone else did it. So you can say, it's so crazy what they are doing. Whether it's some sexual assault story you hear on the news or what an Egyptian man did to an Egyptian woman. But it's much more difficult to take a stance against state violence because a lot of us are implicated in the state. So then we have to, it's much harder to change it and stop it when a government's doing it, right? Than when it's someone where you feel like, oh, rape, let's put in a rape law. The problem is the rape laws aren't implemented. They impact different communities differently. Like if you're a person of color versus not, you're gonna experience rape laws differently. So anyway, my point about Egypt is that the Egyptian government and the transitional government enacted sexual violence against protesters. They forced women to take these virginity tests, women who went to the protests. And of course, those entailed these acts of sexual assault. That's just one example. And then but here's the catch, is the United States supported Mubarak for 30 years, the dictator. He was supported by the US. He wouldn't have had the power he had if it wasn't for the United States. So it also so one of the things that the US does with Egypt is this thing called extraordinary rendition. Does anyone know what that is? What is it? Do you want to try to say it?
It's when I'm not too sure if this is like the complete definition, but it's when you're allowed to simply pluck someone out of a foreign country and interrogate them on US soil.
Or you could take them somewhere else to be tortured. So you basically, it's an agreement the US has with certain countries where there are less stringent torture laws. So the US wants to torture someone, but they can't do it in the US. So they'll take them to Egypt, where there are less stringent torture laws, or Syria or Jordan. And the CIA has these prisons, and they'll torture them there. So the US was doing this with Egypt in Egyptian jails, where the CIA was practicing the torture. And the torture involved rape, always, you know, and sexual assault. And so what I was going to talk about in my talk is that if your own government is enacting rape and sexual assault, then what does that do for women on the streets if they're trying to get accountability? Like, let's say then you get raped or sexually assaulted. Are you going to go to your government to say, please do something to support me, I was just sexually assaulted, when your government itself is participating in sexual assault? Does that make sense? So I was trying to show, like, how do we then address the issues of rape when the state is enacting rape itself? So that's part of the struggle that women's movements are dealing with, that we need to broaden how we define sexual assault, because we're never going to end it if we don't also look at the role. Like, let's say in the United States, there's a huge problem of police brutality. And the police use sexual assault all the time in poor communities and communities of color. It's a fact. I mean, you could Google it, and there's tons of research evidence that the United States police use sexual assault when they target people. So when we hear about police brutality, we don't hear about the sexual part of it. So what if you were a woman of color living in a poor neighborhood or an immigrant community, and you had no resources, and your husband raped you and continually abused you? You might not call the police, because you might be afraid of what the police would do when they show up at your house. So that was what I was doing with the Egyptian example, is that we need to address both at the same time, the individual acts on the street and the way that sometimes we also have to think about how we can hold governments accountable for reinforcing and being complicit in sexual assault. So that was the Egyptian stuff. It was all about the critique of the way the United States portrayed sexual harassment in Egypt.
I see a couple other hands go up, but I do want to be mindful of time and respectful that some of you may or may not have a next class to go to, and the two instructors here may or may not have to go teach another class. So for those of you, Nadine, I don't know about your time,
but there's
two more hands. If there's anybody that needs to quietly leave, thank you. Thank you so much for being here, but I do see there were a couple of other hands up.
You know, they could also just say the questions together, and then I could try to address them together.
Okay, that would be great. Great. Let's pass them on.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Dylan.
Hi, Dylan.
Excellent talk. It's very informative. But I was wondering, always confused me, is the Palestinians had wanted, I guess, equality. Why did they reject the partition plan of 1947, and why did they try to strangle the Israeli nation in the crib by declaring war the day after they declared independence?
So I can give you readings. There are many different narratives about that event, mm-hmm. and many different ways that history went down. And so I think that we just need to read the multiple perspectives. And one suggestion is there is a group of scholars who are Israeli from Israeli universities, and they're called revisionist historians. And if you wanted to look them up, and I could suggest some of their names, they are like re-looking at that history and looking at the complexities that happened. But I would say personally that even if they did reject it, let's say they rejected it because they thought that, let's say they rejected it, I'm being like hypothetical. Let's say they rejected it for a reason that didn't make sense. Like, kind of like what you're alluding to, right? It still doesn't mean that everything that's happened since then is justified. Does that make sense? I know, I'm just saying that, because I think the way you framed it was that if they want everyone to live equally, then why would they have rejected it back then? You mm-hmm. see what I'm saying? So I think we need to both look at what actually happened back then by looking at the multiple narratives, and then also, you know, no matter what happened or happens, what the way the situation has continued is clearly that, you know, has been entailed so much violence and land confiscation that, and since then, Palestinians have over and over accepted, let's say, the 67 borders, again accepted Oslo, but all the promises made and all of those peace negotiations didn't end up being granted. And so we should also then question all of those agreements, right? Not just what happened in 48, mm-hmm. but then say, then why did this happen? And then why did this happen? But thanks for your question. It's a good one. And it is confusing. And I think that it's important to ask that question because it is a difficult one. Thanks.
Was there somebody else that had a question?